The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2023. I'm now here with Dr. Baron 17th Century Shite Poster DDS. I encountered him on Twitter about 9 months ago now, probably when I first got my Twitter account back. So, Dr. Baron, would you like to introduce yourself to the audience?
Yes, you can just call me 17. As far as who I am, I'm just, as far as I'm concerned, a normal person on the internet. I'm basically just this Twitter account. I otherwise don't have any significant media presence or the like.
Right. Well, how would you describe, just so that people, you know, who aren't on Twitter, who aren't following you on Twitter, how would you describe yourself and your general worldview?
Right. I mostly identify with neo-reaction. You know, the thought of Mencius Moldbug, I find his analysis to be really spot on. I wouldn't call myself an orthodox NRX thinker, but that's most heavily informed my understanding. And, you know, in a broader sense, I think that the modern state of progressivism is based, you know, on an utter foundation of lies. And so, you know, my thought is heavily involved in, you know, exploring those falsehoods and trying to maneuver back to some form of truth.
Right. And I think a key part of that is obviously the ability to communicate. And you said that you wanted to talk about the issue of online censorship. This year, I mean, we've talked about it on Millennial in previous years. Not you, because this is your debut on Millennial. But it has been a perennial topic, because really since 20... Well, technically, I guess it was always there on social media. Then Milo got banned from Twitter in 2016. And then in 2017, it stepped up a bit. And certainly by 2018, it was starting to be regarded as a common thing for people to simply be banned. What would you say about social media? Let me know if you want to talk about more than just social media, because the internet is obviously not just social media. But how would you describe the landscape, the culture of social media in the year 2010, for example?
Right. Well, obviously, it was much more freewheeling, much less moderated. I don't feel like there was anywhere near the level of social pressure, media pressure, and at this phase in political pressure, you know, like you have government agencies that are causing, or at least until equity lord Elon Musk took over Twitter, you know, you had social media sites whose directives were being determined by the FBI and other, you know, security groups. So, you know, talking like 12, 15 years ago, obviously it felt, you know, the internet was starting to mature more, but it was way more, you know, open, freewheeling. You could say whatever you wanted. You know, places had moderation, but it felt like a completely different universe to what we live under today.
Yes. I mean, the internet, and Zoomers won't really remember this if at all. When it started, the internet was actually a bit intimidating in the sense that you really didn't know what you were going to encounter. And any forum, bulletin board forum, would have its own culture and its own censorship policies. But generally speaking, you could say whatever you wanted, and including very controversial stuff. And that was part of the... It was just taken for granted. That was part of the internet, people talk now about the Wild West days of the internet, but it really was like that. I mean, that's not mythologizing it inaccurately. It was an amazing period from about 95 to, I would say, about 2015, 16. You go.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, we had obviously this, we'll just call it wokeness, but modern progressivism obviously was accelerating. I first started noticing it around 2009 is when the ideology of it was starting to bubble up in the circles that I ran in those days. And certainly by about 2012 to 2013, it started to get a lot more mainstreamed. And yes, within just a few years after that, this kind of central censorship apparatus had sort of become the norm almost everywhere on the internet. And obviously that had a ton to do with, you know, Trump and that kind of wrecking ball into the system that they weren't expecting. Before we get too much deeper into it, like, you know, we can speak to me, there is, I almost take this stuff for granted at this point that, you know, you just have to censor yourself online and, you know, my friends are banned all the time. Maybe you don't take it quite as for granted because, you know, you have been deplatformed from a lot of places. Like I mentioned to you that I've been watching Millennial Evil for several years now, but I lost track of you for a couple of years while you were off Twitter, for instance. So, you know, for you, I'm sure it's a little more serious, but, you know, to me, it's like this has become the water that surrounds us. And so, you know, it's just the way it is. That's the game. But to me, the really disturbing part of this is that, it's an indicator of something much more serious, which to me is that sort of the logic of liberalism has completed itself, and it failed in two critical ways. The first is that it wasn't able to achieve its goals of equality, you know, not just racially, but between genders, probably even within class. But, you know, that was perhaps its chief goal. And the second one was that, you know, despite all of its propaganda, a great many people just stubbornly refused to believe it. And so once this logic has kind of come to its conclusion and it hasn't been able to achieve these goals, it has advanced from a much more liberal state, a much more freewheeling condition, to a more authoritarian one, explicitly authoritarian. And I would argue across all modes of life, but it's very evident in, you know, online censorship. So, you know, it's not just about, you know, whether you can have a Twitter account and say the N-word on it. It's you know.
Oh, it's much more subtle than that. And right. The other thing to say here is that it's explicit censorship. In mm-hmm. fact, the progressive left are proud of demanding censorship. And this is a big thing. You know, when I was a teenager in the 90s, the left was anti-censorship and delighted in making outrageous films that shocked, you know, Christian conservatives and so on, mm-hmm. violence, sex, and swearing and so on, flouting the social norms really of the past by that time. But speaking as if they were being brave and heroic for doing that, stunning and brave, back in the 90s. And they were proud of being anti-censorship. That was a big thing. And this is even personified in a single person, Sinead O'Connor, who in the early 90s, I wrote an essay about her earlier this year when she died. And she said that there was a quote from her saying that she's against all forms of censorship. That obviously changed in the left in general. And by the time she died, a couple of years ago, she was petitioning for people to be locked up for voicing anti-immigration views.
Right, yes. No,
that's an astonishing turnaround there.
Yes, and I think it is another indication of this kind of phase shift in the form that leftism took. Like basically the old values of leftism, some of which were okay. You know, I have always been a big free speech guy, and I was back when I was on the left, that was part of why, because they were the free speech people. But then, yes, as over the last, well, I guess it's been, yeah, closer to 12 years now, they underwent this phase transition into this authoritarian phase of being. And right, people who, I mean, the NPC meme exists for a reason. It's like they get these commands from Maya, the software update, and suddenly something that was a core value of theirs just a few years ago is now, you know, they've flipped 180, they're against it, and now they're proud to be against it and to enforce these new norms on, you know, people who might have agreed with them 10 years ago.
Yeah, and it's astounding. And they're proud of it. You know, that's the thing. They speak now of censorship as a good thing, a necessary thing, admirable, and it's egregious when someone isn't censoring sufficiently and doesn't have sufficient systems in place to censor.
Yes, right.
I mean, it's remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, right. Well, it's sold to us as a kind of positive freedom where restricting what people are able to say in public is now this new form of freedom where you are free from harassment, from harm, from hatred. So, right, it's repackaged in this way that where they can feel very proud of this new norm they're enforcing and, you know, just outright lie about what is the outcomes of it. Like they're very good at lying to themselves, at deluding themselves about what they're doing, why they're doing, and the outcomes of it. Like that's almost like an underlying precondition of being a leftist. Is this ability to do this?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's almost as if, from the perspective of a naive leftist, it's as if they campaigned for total freedom and then they discovered what that actually means. It means that the nasty, racist, sexist sides of human nature will be allowed free rein. So actually, we don't want total freedom. And in fact, there are huge areas of human experience and human thought that we need cut off from public view, from public access. So that people in general won't be harmed by, well, what they now term hate. It's just this umbrella term, hate.
Right. And not only to sort of hide these things from sight, but the goal is to re-engineer us so that we no longer exist as us with these beliefs. You know, that would be the ideal for them, is if they can somehow reprogram us so that we no longer have these actually very human and, I believe, very factual, you know, beliefs in us. Like that would be their ultimate goal if they could pull it off, is, you know, They always love to sort of engineer this sort of utopian outcome, and it makes them furious when they can't achieve these things, when they bump up against human nature and like it rejects their attempts to reshape things. And then that's when they start striking out at you in vengeance and start actively punishing you. Like, to me, that's the two faces of leftism. You have the drive to do these wonderful utopian things and literally solve all problems, and then once that fails, because it will inevitably fail, then they choose the people who they blame for causing it to fail and, you know, just punish them.
It's funny because they would say the same thing about people who are anti-immigration. Well, those people are just finding a group to scapegoat so that they can then take out all their frustrations on this poor victim minority. But actually, that's what lefties are doing with all sorts of enemies, all sorts of opponents, anyone who disagrees with them. They exert great hatred upon them. It's really disgusting, actually, because it's as if, and you've got to kind of try to psychologize them, because I think they so lack self-examination. It's as if they need to hate, and they're projecting that need to hate onto other people, and then calling them hateful and purveyors of hate. But it's really them. It's that they have this incredible amount of hatred inside them.
I would certainly agree with that. But right, that is part of their psychological process. And, you know, the leftism in general, they're over-socialized the way that Theodore Kaczynski talked about. So they don't have these kinds of, you know, they always seek the more central consensus, and they can't really question themselves. Well, because at this point, especially, you know, if you start to question leftist orthodoxy, then you get booted out of the left and often, you know, canceled.
I've talked about that. Quite on this side of the pond, it's a lot of people that have fallen victim to that, fallen foul of their leftist colleagues, and been cancelled, as they say. But I know it's happened in America as well. Mm-hmm. It's happened everywhere. Leftism now is like a doctrine where you've got, if you're not sufficiently adherent to the doctrine, then you're as good as, you know, the foaming mouth Nazi.
Right. Yes. Right. Like a lot of these people literally believe that people who still hold what we'll call, you know, liberal values of, say, the 2000s or the 90s, like these people are many people on the left, like mainstream figures, not just, you know, random communists, but mainstream figures will consider these people to be, yes, literal fascists, like literal Nazis. And to an extent, they're not wrong because, you know, this kind of they're sort of communist, you know, let's call it, what do you want to call it? Like, global race communism or something like this new form of leftism that's arising. It is essentially communist in nature. And so the only way that history has proven to combat communist uprisings is with fascist uprisings. So from their perspective, you know, the desire for normalcy is a form of fascism because both from that direction and because these people champion basically the most dysfunctional people in creation. Like those are their standard bearers. It's like,
like George Floyd, for example.
Right. Yes. No, that's a wonderful example. Like George Floyd is literally a martyr to them. You know, this guy's, he was a criminal, you know, a porn star,
a thug, a junkie, a burglar. I mean, it's pretty bad.
Yeah. And this guy was their hero that kicked off these monumental race riots and this racial reckoning and things. And so right, anyone who doesn't believe in uplifting like these the worst people in society, because that does come at the expense of normal people, obviously, is, you know, less a fascist. And from their perspective, it's not wrong, but it's funny to me that, like, you know, basically normalcy is now designated as far-right extremism.
Exactly, and this is a thing that's often said, that the normal view of say 2010 on all sorts of issues is now seen as an extreme position. It's amazing to say that out loud, because how fast this has changed, and this is why I think it's a mistake to say that culture hasn't changed in the last 23 years, because it, you know, since the year 2000, because it really has. It's changed more than it changed in the 90s. And I think really in the 2010s, not so much in the 2000s. I think the 2000s was a sort of dead decade, just in general. But the 2010s was bristling. It was fizzling with change at this level, in this way, that the morals and the ideas that you are expected to hold are quite radically different from those you were expected to hold in 2010. You know, whether it's gay marriage or the trans thing, or even mass immigration and multiculturalism and diversity. I mean, those were there in 2010, but it's massively stepped up since then, to the point where any deviation is an outrage and could certainly lose you your job, for example.
Right. Well, that's precisely what I mean by the leftism, by which I include liberalism, went through this phase transition from these earlier forms to this much more authoritarian and centralized one, which also, you know, actively censors basically the entire internet.
Yes, and that is what they want. I mean, and it's not just, you see, the thing is, the trouble with this terminology, talking about the left, obviously there is the activist left and the sort of SJW, the purple-headed 21-year-old idiot who's on a women's studies degree and thinks she knows everything because she's educated. Mm-hmm. And is actually just demented and, you know, paranoid, neurotic and whatever. But you've also got much more calm and well-moneyed, well-resourced, well-connected, powerful people who espouse all the same ideas as the demented 21-year-old. And well, right, who are probably much more accomplished people as well. You know, people in their 40s, 50s, who head up Silicon Valley companies, for example.
Right. No, the ideology is definitely not limited to, right, the purple-haired college sophomore brigade. Like, it is basically swept across almost the entire elite class. That's part of what it allowed it to advance to this next stage of being, is it attained this sort of almost total control of, you know, the education system, of media, increasingly of the government itself, you know, the deep state, quote unquote, which is, you know, turns out is very real and is run through with, I mean, the U.S. military basically believes the same things as about the most far left activists, in the nation at this point.
Yes, because it would be illegal for them to believe anything else.
Right. And I think that, well, so here's the underlying problem here is that, like, so we haven't achieved racial equality, for instance. Why not? There's only really two possible explanations. And this is, you know, where the crux of this breaks. And one is the woke explanation, that we live under a society of, like, totalizing systemic racism, and that holds some groups down. Some groups oppress others for their own benefit. And the alternative answer is something that is fundamentally at odds with the underlying ideology of post-war democracy in general, which is that it might just be possible that there is significant biological inborn difference between different groups of people. So to me, part of the reason that this ideology has made the sweep is because basically the right, even the right, cannot resist this, because it is the framework of our entire culture at this point. And since we still don't have, you know, racial equality in the year of, let's just say 2015 is when this really accelerated, then unless you reject that bedrock premise of the post-war ideology that we all exist in, then the woke are correct. And so only someone who is kind of a actual racist or some, you know, you would have to be backwards to reject this idea, in other words, like, unless you do reject all of it. But there's a reason that these people cannot stand up against wokeness, because, you know, they have no, what's the alternative? It's something too horrifying for most of them to comprehend.
Yes. Yes, I agree. And I think this is what has hobbled the mainstream right. There's so much invested now in the idea of racial equality that they, as in that the races are mentally identical. There's so much invested in that it's become so critical to believe in that they can't now say, well, the emperor has no clothes on. The races simply aren't equal, because that now means that is now an incendiary thing to say, and certainly career ending. And it has ended careers. I mean, even was it James Watson, the scientist, a few years ago, lost his Nobel Prize and all this kind of thing. It is the answer. It is the truth. But at this point, it's so controversial to say that hardly anyone on the right will say it. And so you're left with, well, the only possible explanation as to why black people aren't dominating at university is that we are racist against them and are stopping them from getting ahead. We're stopping them from getting into those PhD programs and so forth, because otherwise they would obviously be flourishing at that level.
Right. I mean, their internal logic is correct. And that's part of what makes this challenging, because they basically own the internal logic of the entire system that we exist in, right? This idea that all groups are equal, and possibly even all people are equal, even within groups. And the only reason that one person, you know, that one white guy is smarter than another white guy is because, you know, the less intelligent one was deprived of resources in childhood.
Yes, his parents read too many books to him. I mean, I've actually seen middle-class parents saying, yeah, we don't read books because we don't want him to have too much of an advantage, an unfair, unearned advantage over
right,
his.
Yes.
I mean, I've seen, I don't know if they actually live by that, or if it's just some bullshit that they come out with in public, but I've seen people saying that, and I think there were actually newspaper, like magazine articles to that effect, that it's a bad, why you shouldn't read books to your children. A couple of years ago, I seem to remember seeing that. And, you know, again, according to their internal logic, that does make sense. Because why should he have an unfair advantage? And he didn't earn it. So why should he be better at reading than his peers who come from more impoverished backgrounds? I mean, it does actually make sense within their moral code.
Right. But it speaks to the perversity of this moral code that a parent would willingly and knowingly withhold resources from their own child so that their child will struggle in life to degrees that they didn't need to, all because, you know, we basically need to cast off our privilege so that others can finally be unshackled from the burdens we put upon them. I don't know. It's you know, it really is a sort of cuckold ideology. Or you would kick your own children out of the nest at the expense of, you know, this other type of bird. It's
so unnatural. And when you reduce it to the level of the family and say, well, okay, would you artificially disadvantage your own children? You see the absurdity of it. At the national level, people don't tend to see the absurdity of it, but they should, I think. I mean, they should see that actually my priority should be my own people. And it's perverse for me not to do that. And I remember a Swedish judge who refused to deport a rapist to Somalia. He'd raped a Swedish woman. And this judge refused to deport him because, well, if we deport him to Somalia, then he'll rape Somalian women. And why are they worth less than Swedish women? So,
right.
Well, the answer is because you're fucking Swedish. You, judge, are Swedish, so you should prioritize Swedish women. But they've got this idea of a universal principle where it doesn't matter that the judge is Swedish, that he or she, can't remember which, should prioritize all of humanity at once. But of course, what that means is that everyone else just eats you alive because you're not prioritizing your own interests.
Right, yes, right. Well, this ideology scales, right, from basically, like, yes, your own family all the way out to the entirety of humanity, because it more or less believes that if you are Swedish and live in Sweden and you have this nice society in Sweden, you are only there because of an accident of birth. It has nothing to do with your ancestors and the specific people who created that place. Like, you are just a cosmic accident, you know. You were ensouled randomly. You could just as easily have been born in Bangladesh or wherever. And so, therefore, it's morally wrong to keep people who, just through accident of their own birth, live in, you know, impoverished or war-torn nations. Like, morally, those people have the exact same rights to your country that you do. And keeping them out is, you know, almost an act of violence against them.
Yes, yes. And that's certainly how the left perceive it. So to get back to the matter of censorship, they have a whole moral system. They have a whole doctrine. And it actually becomes more developed year by year and more restrictive year by year. It's easy to forget this. It used to be that most people weren't very political. And you could have friends of different political persuasions. Families didn't break up because of it. The relatives didn't fall out with each other and disavow each other. And you didn't get fired for political views, even if you voiced them, even if they were unfashionable. The idea of getting fired for your political views would have been outrageous a few decades ago. Whereas now it's pretty much legally required that you be fired for saying certain political beliefs in the workplace. So it's been a massive change. And as I say, the doctrine gets more restrictive. At this point, there is really one opinion you're allowed to have, supposed to have, on every single issue. And if you don't have that opinion on it, then the NPCs will be let loose on you. And social media and online censorship is really the main means by which this has been done. I mean, it's also employment protocols in the workplace. It's also the mainstream media. But I think, certainly for our purposes, because you're an avid Twitter user, I've been on various platforms. For our purposes, the main thing is social media and the censorship thereof. And where would you say that began. I remember in YouTube in like the first half of the 2010s, you could basically, my memory of it, maybe this is wrong, but my memory of it is that the only time a channel would get shut down was if it was some guy on a making photos in his grainy webcam in his garage with a swastika banner in the background, and he was raving about the ends and the keys, and then his channel might get shut down, but if he was polite and he just behaved in a civilized way, then he was safe. His channel wouldn't get shut down, and that was the environment into which I entered as a content creator in 2014, and had these premises, axiomatic truths that my social media profile was mine, my YouTube channel was mine, and it would never get shut down. There was no reason why that would ever happen. And is that how you remember YouTube in those days?
Yeah, I was, I was a little more of a normie politically back then, but so I wasn't seeking out the more outrageous stuff. But somebody like Stephen Molyneux used to have a huge channel on YouTube and discuss a lot of these things that will now get you, axed almost immediately if you happen to phrase them in without the exquisite precision necessary to bypass the censor. So, relatedly, it wasn't that long ago that Reddit wasn't even gay. So it was absolutely, a completely different ecosystem where, if you were like explicitly hateful, calling for violence, basically being a lunatic, of course they're going to kick you off. But that it was not at all the case that, having the improper political opinion would get you deplatformed, and you have no recourse to do anything about that.
Yeah. And Reddit is an interesting one, because I remember seeing a meme about a year ago, and it said that the more censorship you have, the more leftist the platform will be. And the more leftist the platform is, the more censored it is.
Yes.
And the less censorship it has, the more right-wing it will be. And the more right-wing it is, the less censored it will be. And he used the examples of Reddit on the left and 4chan on the right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
That is so true.
Yeah, there's an old poll meme that used to sound, maybe questionable, but right. It basically said that exact same thing, that any unmoderated online space will inevitably become right wing. And that's absolutely true these days, which obviously is part of why they need all this excess moderation, all this increasingly centralized and narrow censorship. Although let's not. Part of the ways that the system has accelerated, though, and become more authoritarian is it isn't just, for my purposes, social media is, where I hang out and where I put most of my time in. But the system has increasingly made it where they will basically economically unperson you if you step out of line. Like we saw this with the Canadian truckers when they were resisting the vaccine mandates there. A great deal of those people had their bank accounts frozen.
And this is why it's important to say that when we're talking about censorship, it's not just some guy, ranting about the keys and the ends. It's also someone saying, well, I support the truckers. It's someone saying, well, I don't believe that the vaccine is safe. Et cetera. It goes to the category of hate is really very, very expandable. It can include all sorts of things.
Right. And in that case, you have another, what used to be a sort of basic premise of liberalism, which they still defend in other areas like abortion, but the bodily autonomy used to be, more of a leftist issue or an inviolable premise of liberalism. And specifically with the vaccine, now they're mandating that you take a medical procedure, and certainly in an experimental and, as it turned out, a medical procedure that didn't even work and could often cause more damage to the young people who took it than you know, the virus it was supposed to prevent. But right, so the system is now willing to use this more overt force against people who step out of line. In those ways, it's increasingly economic. That's sort of how the system uses force. Like, it's very shy to use violence directly, but it's not at all shy, and this is very new, but it's not at all shy about deploying other means, especially economic ones, to silence people, to remove people from the system, to unperson people, basically.
Yeah, and it's a frightening thing, because I think we all grew up with, and this is the irony, we all grew up hearing about Big Brother and you know, the party and Ingsoc and all that. But we were also led to believe, hold on a second. We were also led to believe that these were fanciful notions that would never, it's something we've all got to be aware of, but it's off the past. And then suddenly you find it actually it's emerging in the real world. And that's a real, and of course the scary thing is that so many people didn't even notice it. They didn't notice this happening.
Or they willingly participated in it.
Indeed, cheered it along. I could write a book about my experience of COVID. It was a very scary thing. Because again, you realize, okay, most of the public are NPCs. And this is why I think it's almost a mistake to talk about the left as having autonomy, or because as you said, they don't really have self-examination. They really do just respond to incentives from on high. And their thinking is shaped and reshaped almost by the week according to those messages.
Right. And basically all the central powers of society right now are also owned by leftists. So, you know, there isn't even really a moderating force within these groups. They just reach conclusions. Even their scientific ones are increasingly flawed because they are based on faulty premises of where they're getting their information from. Their foundational assumptions are wrong, so a lot of their extrapolated logic is wrong. Increasingly, even when it comes to science or something like the vaccine, which leads to an absurd crisis. And frankly, the vaccine mandates were one of the most, like, I would never have imagined 10 years ago that we would have that level of authoritarianism in Western so-called liberal countries. Like, it would have blown my mind. I wouldn't have believed it if, you know, I had traveled back to see myself in even 2013 and told me that. I'd be like, this is, you know, this is a fantasy. It is a Big Brother thing that can never happen here. You know, it's absurd to think about the difference in culture and what is accepted among, right, very leading, very important people, basically the core of our political system right now.
Absolutely. And well, that, I guess, brings us to the present day, because I've got a feeling that, okay, let's go back a bit in the chronology, because just to tell the story, just for the sake of telling it in a straightforward way, it started with YouTube. It didn't start with YouTube. YouTube was one of the most probably the most pro freedom of speech platforms up until about 2019. All the others, I think, were worse. Facebook, Instagram were dreadful. Then Twitter. And then YouTube was, I think, the last to become really doctrinaire and scary, because it was random and you just didn't know. And they would do little tricks, like they would strike all three of your videos all at once, so that enabled them to just shut down your channel. So you didn't have any chance to react. It was really sick. Especially, you've got to consider, for anyone who's not a content creator, you've got to consider that this was people's livelihoods that were being destroyed. And I mean, there were the people in charge, the people who were doing this, who were probably not of the highest rank at these corporations, they were just toying with content creators and toying with their livelihoods and screwing them over. In a really big way, because, you know, when this started, there really weren't any viable alternatives. I mean, there was nothing there was no other Twitter. Gab wasn't an adequate replacement for Twitter. It was a different thing. It was its own thing, fine, but it wasn't anywhere near as popular as Twitter. Certainly not with the normies and, you know, politicians and journalists or whatever. YouTube, there was BitChute, and then there was Odyssey and Rumble, but they are not YouTube. And I like them, and I'm grateful for, I certainly am grateful for them, but they're simply not YouTube. So right. To lose your place on those platforms is still a crippling blow. And I think it's just worth remembering that, because it's an era that I think, I do think we're perhaps coming towards the end of it. But anyway, I want to say this. So just to go back to it. So Twitter started just shutting people down, banning. The appeals were just ignored. That all of that. We've been through all of that. Then Elon Musk. Well, then Substack started. And Substack doesn't seem to be happy with the idea of censorship or banning people. And I don't know how it's managed to so far resist calls to censor. I don't understand. But so far, it does seem to have. And I haven't heard of anyone being banned from Substack, ever. And then Elon Musk bought Twitter and has reinvented that website. And so there's a whole new character to this now. Would you have anything to say about what I've said?
Yeah, well, I mean, as an example, I don't know if you saw it or were too busy, but Elon Musk unbanned the account of Alex Jones on Twitter earlier today and was in a space with him, if I understand. I didn't have time to listen to it myself.
I didn't know about the space, but I knew he'd been unbanned, yes.
Yeah, so these alternatives are opening. I was thinking about this myself. This kind of gross illiberalism and authoritarianism has basically become undeniable at this point. And even to the point where a lot of people who wanted to turn a blind eye to it, like I believe that Elon Musk probably believed a lot of these things, like the things that, this dominant censorship regime. He was probably a lot more sympathetic to it just a handful of years ago. But as, it's sort of crimes and abuses, including, you know, things like the FBI claiming that Hunter Biden's laptop was Russian disinformation, arguably altering the outcome of the 2020 presidential election. You know, people who have real concerns about freedom, it's been much more difficult for them to ignore this.
And it's like the idea of the totalitarian regime, where people are expected not only to adhere to the doctrine and the political beliefs, but also to ignore basic truths and obvious truths and to believe obvious lies, like the chocolate ration went up this week when everyone knows that it went down, that kind of thing. I think that's the censorship had advanced very, very fast to that level, where you're meant to believe that Hunter Biden's laptop is just a load of rubbish when you know that it's not. And of course, that COVID is killing everyone when you know that it's not. And the vaccine is harmless when it's clearly not. But you're supposed to keep believing or at least spouting these lies. And I think at that point, even someone who's middle of the road, apolitical, centrist, even they start thinking, we are now living in a sort of totalitarian state.
Right. And okay, so to back up a little bit and address some of the timeline that you were talking about, I think, you know, while many of these issues were sort of simmering in the background and the leftists were slowly, you know, the SJWs or wokeness was slowly infiltrating institutions and sort of gathering its influence there, the tipping point was obviously 2016, the election of Donald Trump, to a degree Brexit as well. But what was going on there is that, you know, what we'll call the regime discovered then that something was dreadfully wrong with the system it thought it had. It sort of thought it had sort of total ideological control. And it didn't need to be as authoritarian because it sort of manipulated viewpoints and information behind the scenes in a way that they just became accepted as common knowledge. So yeah. Therefore, it would get most of its political goals met eventually just through force of it basically creating the most sophisticated propaganda machine in human history. And, you know, that process was supposed to proceed uninterrupted. You know, Obama was supposed to pass the torch to Hillary, who would more or less follow these same beliefs and slowly advance progressivism, but, you know, mostly be a sort of, they could pretend to be more of like a centrist liberal approach, you know, just the sort of enlightened scientific democratic rule that that used to be a lot more believable. And so when 2016 happened, what happened was there was basically the biggest counter-propaganda campaign of all time, waged almost entirely on social media. You know, Facebook, Twitter, even Reddit was allowed to participate in the election of Donald Trump. And I do think that was, you know, I don't think Trump would have gotten elected without that, right? And so this sort of broke the regime's mind because it wasn't supposed to happen, and it exposed that they had a huge liability in their ability to continually reshape society towards their political goals, which was, you know, that normal people were getting online and talking to each other openly and honestly. And so when this sort of flaw in the matrix was discovered, what we in neo-reactionaryism call the cathedral, which is like the central, you know, information apparatus, immediately began to put pressure on these social media platforms to begin censoring. Like, we saw it immediately in the wake of Trump's election. Like, New York Times was explicitly calling for more moderation of YouTube, of Twitter, of Facebook, you know, citing disinformation, citing, you know, Russian influence allowed to spread wild. All of these lies, basically, as it turned out. But they were able to use these because they have so much cultural power that they could just force these platforms to sort of take on more and more moderation. And of course, the platforms themselves had progressives within their, you know, their own ruler.
Yes, structure. Yes, they were being pressured to do what they already wanted to do anyway.
Right. So it wasn't that hard, you know, to get them to take on these things. Because, you know, and you're probably aware of this, but back in, what was it, 2009 or 2008, when Twitter was kicking off, Jack claimed that Twitter was the free speech wing of the free speech party. And fast forward 8 years later, and suddenly he's enforcing all forms, all new forms of moderation, including to the point where eventually, like, you can't even say, you know, if you were to say, like, the vaccine causes myocarditis or doesn't prevent infection, like, you could get banned for that, for yes. saying things that are now accepted fact. But right, that's to sort of summarize, 2016 exposed this uncontrolled territory, and they took immediate steps to control it, and they were successful on almost every platform.
Yeah, absolutely. I do agree with you for sure that it was the Trump's election really scared them, and that clearly galvanized the censorship drive. But it's important to remember that Milo, and whatever you think about him, doesn't matter. He got banned before the Trump election. I think it was in August 2016. So that's between the Brexit referendum and the Trump election. I don't really think that, well, I don't know. I don't think that Brexit was that important to Silicon Valley, that they would have banned him for that. So the point is that the censorship was already there prior to the Trump winning the election, but clearly that, galvanized it. And
it provided full justification for it.
Yeah. Yeah. It scared them. I mean, an important thing to remember is that I think in 2012, 2013, there was a Google conference where the CEO of Google said, we're building towards, or we're heading towards, an internet that will be censorship proof. You know, so at that point, they were still, like, people like him still believed in the 90s, 2000s notion of that censorship is bad. We want a world without censorship.
Yes.
But yeah, within a few years, that was radically changed.
Well, right. Then democracy did something it shouldn't have. So democracy had to be reshaped by these powers so that it would behave according to their, you know, their political ends.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, it, as you say, they were successful on all platforms because all platforms became police states and heavily, heavily censorious. And randomly as well, as I've said, that was part of it, was that you never knew when the hammer was going to fall or why or what justification would be used, what fatuous justification would be used when they finally got rid of you. So it was a scary time. But as I say, what do you think the situation is now with Musk taking Twitter and platforms like Substack? Would you say that Substack is the only one that's anti-censorship, or are there others? I don't know if you're familiar with that. What would you say the situation is now?
Well, in response to this ongoing and expanding censorship regime, which has included more and more obvious lies that have been, you know, say, I don't know what Elon Musk thought back in 2017, but say he was initially sympathetic to the Russiagate stuff. And then a few years later, turns out that's all been exposed as basically a deep state hoax pulled on us to try to color revolution Trump. And then, you know, we go through all the COVID stuff, much of which also turns out to be lies. And you were booted off the platform for telling the truth. So say Musk and others like him were witnessing this, it became clear that whatever the threats of Trump and Trumpism that the regime used to impose these heavy-handed censorship guidances across all these platforms, they were also censoring a great deal of necessary and true speech. Like, you know, so these guys see that the truth and a large swath of political opinion that isn't necessarily even all that controversial, you know, not as controversial as some of the things we have discussed, but a lot of, you know, normie people were getting booted off. So they have, there's been, and I don't want to, I'm not heavily white-pilled about it, but there's certainly been a sort of awakening of the ants of some of these tech giants, you know, some of whom simply wanted to create a platform where conservatives could speak their mind, which I think, you know, maybe Rumble just, could qualify as that, or arguably Odyssey. But so, but yeah, Substack, I think, is, as far as I can tell, it actually is just deeply committed to the principle of free speech. And it's willing so far to, you know, stand up to all challengers on that. All right. So on one hand, we have these kind of, you know, this ant awakening, creating and trying to, it's what Musk is doing. Because see, what I would have thought it would have happened before this is that we would have had a kind of parallel structures built up. Because the way I'm seeing it is that society is basically schisming into two separate spheres of, you know, what's, and almost entirely separated from each other in terms of where they get their news, what their fundamental beliefs are, their values. It's like two different cultures. And most people, or people are increasingly being filtered into one or the other. So I would have guessed prior to what, like, was last November when Musk bought Twitter, that this process would have accelerated. The right would have been a lot more marginalized because the central powers are, you know, all beholden to this leftist ideology and control, you know, Twitter, Facebook, Reddit, et cetera, YouTube. And so, you know, alternatives would have sprung up, and I was, you know, very happy to see that. But they were always, to me, going to be much smaller, you know, sort of backwaters in their way, not terribly influential. People could survive and have, content creators could have careers on them, which is excellent. But, you know, they would sort of be excluded from the main conversations on social media. And so yeah. Musk buying Twitter and then actually following through with a fair amount of reopening it is, well, it's basically like an outside context problem. It was unexpected, and it's kind of unpredictable as to where it will go. But it's a great validation of great man theory, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Because in the end, it took someone with massive financial power to take this castle back, as it were.
And the will to do so, to reverse this seemingly inevitable historical process. Elon Musk stood up and said, no, this is a bunch of bullshit. I'm buying Twitter, the whole thing, and we're changing the rules, which is, you know, you just don't expect that to happen unless a very unusual character does it.
Yeah, it was a very unexpected thing. And I think it was announced, God, I can't remember the timeline now, but I seem to remember that it was May last year when he first talked about it. And then I think it was October last year when it actually took it over. And I think the last millennial December, I think it hadn't really taken hold yet. He was still in charge, but we hadn't really seen the developments of it yet. I think that's the timeline. I might have it wrong. But anyway, throughout this year, we have seen the development of it. And I do think it's broadly in the right direction. From his point of view, he might have to do this in a piecemeal fashion, because even if he does want to, you know, let everyone back on, maybe he feels he can't do that all at once. He has to gradually prepare the public for that happening. I don't know, and I don't want to get into, you know, four-dimensional chess and all that, but he is letting people back incrementally, as you said, Alex Jones just today. So that suggests to me that it is the way I've just described, where he's doing it bit by bit rather than all at once. I do think that he's re-envisioning Twitter as a general purpose app, which I don't like the idea of. But you know, from his point of view, he's an empire builder, so I understand why he wants that. But more importantly for us, I think he's envisioning it as a general avenue for freedom of speech and open discourse, and we do sorely need that. To get back to what you said at the very beginning, that you know, the world is not as it should be, and in order to find a way forward, we need to at least be able to discuss the problems and name the problems, and that really is what the censorship prevented us from doing, even naming the problems, let alone discussing solutions for them.
Right, and obviously it's wholly deliberate. And no, your timeline was pretty much correct. As I recall, he was like sort of threatening to buy Twitter in like April of last year, and then there was some dancing back and forth. And the deal went through in, I think, May, or like he tried to pull out of it, and then like the courts sort of 4D chess themselves into forcing him to buy it. And now they lost one of the most important sort of aspects of their propaganda machine. And it has been reopened. Although again, it's wonderful, but I don't want to be super white-pilled about it, because it's not like, you know, it does look like Elon Musk's understanding of these problems is advancing almost by the day. So I don't know that he actually had a great master plan to bring people back in waves. I think he's sort of more and more understanding exactly the scope of what he's up against, and maybe seeing more of the lies that were told to him over time. And he's overdoing those, you know, as he gets that new information. But right, before I lose this line of thought, like I would not consider him especially right wing or other figures like Mark Andreessen and people involved in EAC, the movement around AI and preventing it from being neutered and sort of lobotomized like everything else has been. Those people aren't really, you know, they're not hard right figures. You might even say that they're like Reddit libertarian types. Or like,
yeah, they're in the mold of that, the sort of the 90s tech guys who aren't terribly political. They're just interested in the truth and in coding.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like, let's not, I just don't want it to sound like I think Elon Musk is, you know, our guy who secretly believes everything we do, and that's why, and it's going to be a paradise for us. But he does seem much more committed to free speech and to, you know, actually actively opposing a lot of the lies of the regime at this point. Like that has been very interesting to watch happening almost in real time as he's discovering these things for himself.
Yeah, I agree. I think he went into this somewhat naively. And I don't say that as a criticism. I just think he was not cognizant of certain things when he went into this. And once he got ownership of Twitter and was responsible for it and to being held responsible for it, then I think he gradually realized what the pressures are in the world, what the powers and principalities are. And as you say, what he was really up against. And I think, I don't know if he would have done it had he known in advance how much shit he was going to get and how powerful his adversaries would turn out to be. The ADL, Media Matters, George Soros, to say nothing of, you know, the WEF, the UN, all of that, and the rest of Silicon Valley. I mean, he's, and then the deep state, you know, the governments, the various governments, and let's not forget the EU, constantly threatening him with sanctions and huge fines if he doesn't get more censorious. I mean, it's very much mask off.
And there's a very clear parallel to Trump. Like, would Trump have gotten elected if he knew all the shit they were going to put him through? But I mean, Trump probably would have, because he can't help himself. But that is to me, like, the very interesting thing about these kind of like great men figures who step in and interrupt these seemingly inevitable historical processes. A lot of the time, they're not acting with perfect information. They're just acting on sort of like very deep and very strong instincts that something is wrong and they need to be the ones to step up and change it, because no one else is doing it. No one has the courage or the insight to do so. So they have to step up themselves, no matter the shitstorm that is going to be aligned against them once they do it. But I don't think they did have any idea how big, you know, the counterattack on them would be once they did this.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, I guess I would end by asking, what do you have any predictions for how this is going to develop in the future?
I am somewhat blackpilled on the short-term future, like 10 or 20 years. I think the system has gained immense control over, you know, pretty much every institution that matters. An increase, you know, the entire educational system believes these insane things. The entire media system pretty much believes these things. You know, increasingly, most social media platforms believe these things. So I don't know how you just undo this ideology that's been embedded in everyone. It would take, you know, in like a, I don't know, perhaps even full-blown social collapse or something, which doesn't strike me as hugely likely. But so that to me is a short-term problem that is not, I just don't see this going away easily. Now, it's possible it's something and it could break. And, you know, one of the underlying foundations of the ideology gets snapped and then, you know, the rest of it collapses. But I don't think that is highly likely until things get significantly worse, significantly more restrictive, and you know, just the range at which. So yeah, I hate to think that, but I do think that will be the short-term future. I don't think this ideology can last, you know, for 1,000 years, though. I could easily see it breaking in a generation, 50 years. I don't know. Hopefully it'll be a lot sooner than that. But right, the fundamental problem to me is, well, it's twofold. Like I said, the width that the ideology has spread to. And second, the fact that, as we were discussing earlier, the logic of it is embedded in the foundational logic of our entire post-war culture. So the only real way to move past it is to discard that foundation. And it would take a lot to push us past that point. It's not impossible, but, you know, but that's, you know, you have to break that foundation before something new and stable can exist. Because, you know, with, in Elon Musk's case, you know, what if he decides to sell Twitter, or, you know, what if he drops dead, or, you know, he loses interest and is more interested in Mars, then it gets reinfiltrated and suddenly the space is, you know, I don't see it as, it'll be reinfiltrated all over again. So until there is a Right. A sort of fundamental change in our understanding of the world we live in, that we're going to live in an unstable ideological position until then.
That is a sobering analysis. And I do agree. I hadn't thought of that. You know, what happens if he does lose interest in this for whatever reason? Maybe he just can't be bothered taking the bullshit anymore. He's too stressed with it. He's got other things to do that are more fun. Because he does seem to be a bit of a thrill seeker. I could imagine him just deciding to throw in the towel. And in which case, what happens with Twitter or X or whatever? That is a scary thing. But I think I'm a bit more optimistic than you. I think that things are going in a good direction. And as you say, the ideology cannot survive very long. I don't think it will be 50 years. I mean, it wasn't. How long was it in the Soviet Union? It was 60 years. That was with open totalitarianism. I don't think this is going to last 50 years.
Well, I hope not.
Yeah.
to me, the problem is, though, that some parts of it are extremely durable. And like, people want to believe in equality. And that really is widespread everywhere in our fundamental assumptions. You know, it is interesting. A lot of much more normal people are sort of tiptoeing around or even outright taking up ideas that there are big differences between us. And, you know, so maybe there could be some kind of preference cascade, but I'm afraid there'll just be like parallel societies within the overarching thing for a little longer until something breaks, until I guess the left goes too far, maybe. But right, to me, I just don't see these guys. Let's say they're, you know, so the tech libertarians, they're more interested in free speech. It's hard for me to see that. I don't know, unless maybe AI is another thing that could break things apart. That's a very much an unknown situation that could really change things in ways I couldn't begin to predict. But yeah, I just see this system as untenable. Even like these, although it is really nice that, you know, Musk took over Twitter. We have places like Rumble, Substack that allow people to make a living and get their voice out there in, you know, to large audiences. So that has been a significant reform from like the sort of the dark depths of censorship that arose between like 2017 to 2021 or so. So that is a big white pill.
Oh, I definitely agree. I just think the situation is much better than it was in that time, that period. It was a dreadful period. Especially if, like me, you were a content creator making your living from creating content, from creating videos and so on. So yeah, it was a bad period, and I do think that things are better now. So that's a nice note to end on. So okay. Oh well, I should check if there are any super chats. Hold on a second. Let me just check that. Okay. All right. Okay, there is one. It's from Mr. Cholley, and he says, "Thanks, Woz, for another millennial, and Merry Christmas. Alex Jones unbanned. We are so back." Alex has red-pilled so many to the fact that the Chi-Coms run Hollywood and Arab Muslims run the central banks and the Federal Reserve. Thank you. Yes, agreed. I know Alex Jones is not ideal and he does have some far out ideas, but nonetheless, I think it's better that he's on Twitter than that he's banned from it. And I hope that other people follow and other people are unbanned. All right, well, let's leave it there. So Dr. Barron's 17th century shite poster DDS, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2023.
Yes, thank you for having me on. As I said, I've been watching for years, so it was something of an honor to be invited on myself.
Oh, well, you're very welcome. I think this went well. So, all right. Well, I'll be back in half an hour with the final stream for tonight, which is Porphyrogenitus. He's a tweeter as well that I've known for many years. Okay, so I'll see you then. In the meantime, bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. T-shirts and mugs and other wondrous gifts are available at the merchandise store. Impress your family, friends, colleagues, and business partners with these incredible items. Oh. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.